We are into the book of Exodus, and we're going to pick up with chapter 4 today. As picking up in chapter 4, we're in the middle of that conversation that Moses had when he first, I would say, comes face to face with God, but not exactly like that. He comes face to face with a bush that's on fire and it's not getting burned up. So we're familiar with that, and he stops to look, and then God starts speaking to him. And as we've already covered, God has a job for him. He wants him to go back, confront Pharaoh, and he's going to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. And Moses is a little hesitant, and that's what we're going to see as we go forward. Here in chapter 4, verse 1, Moses said, well, what if they won't believe me or listen to my voice? And they'll say, well, the Lord hasn't appeared to you. Which, to me, seems pretty realistic of Moses. I mean, if I came in here and said, hey, I was talking to God in my office, you might be saying, well, you might believe I was talking to him, but not that he appeared and talked to me. You know, or say, give us some kind of proof. So God actually isn't upset about that. God had planned for this eventuality, so he apparently had these miracles already ready to go. Although now that I say that, it seems kind of funny, because I guess God always has miracles ready to go. I don't know that he has to go in his garage and get them all worked up. But he doesn't hesitate. He says, Moses, well, what's that in your hand? A rod? Well, throw it down on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from it, which makes sense. Moses is like most of us and isn't eager to hang around with snakes. But reach out, take it by the tail. Let's give Moses credit. Although he ran from the snake, he's willing to obey God and go back and grab it by the tail, which they say, if you want to catch a snake, that's not the way to do it. Am I right? Yeah, that's what I see on nature shows and hear, but I generally am like Moses. I'm keeping my distance from them. So this is so they'll believe. Verse 6, furthermore, put your hand in your bosom. So he's wearing something, a robe, so it's sort of like stick your hand in there, pull it out, and it's leprous. Ah! Now put it back in. He puts it back in and comes out, and it's restored again. Again, this is another thing we can give Moses credit for, having some bravery, because when you have something diseased like that, sticking it back in, you know, next to your flesh is something you wouldn't want to do. So he's showing good trust and courage. And God's going to give him another miracle. You know, by this point, Moses will believe him, so he doesn't have him demonstrate this, but he says, if they won't believe the first sign, if they won't believe the second one, we're down to verse 9. You can get some water out of the river, he's referring to the Nile, and when you take that water from the river, if you dump it out on dry land, it'll become blood. So there's three miracles, and these miracles are going to make a strong impression on the Egyptians. For one thing, snakes were often objects of worship. The Nile, even more so. I mean, the Nile was one of the great gods of the Egyptians, and they depended on it for life. So the idea that, you know, you can turn the water from the Nile into blood is pretty phenomenal. I'm not sure about leprosy, except it's worth saying leprosy was something that was incurable. The idea that you could make it come and go would put you on a godlike plane, because they didn't have antibiotics or anything like that to deal with that type of disease. Now Moses still hesitant. Verse 10, Moses says, oh, my Lord, I'm not eloquent, neither before nor since you've spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech, slow of tongue. The word Moses said in the Hebrew is, I'm not a man of words, which I kind of like better. I wish they just translated it literally. Now, some have said that when Moses said, I'm slow of tongue, and matter of fact, I remember hearing this pretty often when I was a young person in the church, that Moses had a stutter. Which is possible, but it doesn't specifically say so. That's making an assumption that we can't prove. There's other interpretations, and I would keep in mind what I referenced last week in Acts chapter 7, verse 22. Again, Stephen the Martyr's sermon described Moses as a man mighty in words and deeds. So a man who's mighty in words as well as deeds, you know, probably didn't have, you know, it doesn't imply a speech impediment. It could be that he's out of practice speaking Hebrew and or Egyptian. And of course, I think the biggest thing is he's trying to make an excuse. Moses has found a happy life as a shepherd out here in the Midian wasteland, and he doesn't want to have to go back and do all this. So God's not having any of it. Verse 11, the Lord said, who's made man's mouth, or who makes the mute, or the deaf, or the seeing, and the blind? Have not I, the Eternal? In other words, Did you forget you're talking to God here? I can take care of these things. Now, therefore, go. I'll be with your mouth, and I'll teach you what you should say. The idea of having God with you in whatever he commands you to do should be encouraging. But Moses still isn't done. Verse 13, he said, "Oh, my Lord, please send by the hand of whoever else you may send." Basically, Moses is saying, please send someone else. You know, it comes down to it, I really don't want to do this. By this time, you get the feeling God's a little angry. Matter of fact, not just a feeling, it says so in verse 14, the anger of the Lord was kindled. It said, well, isn't Aaron the Levite your brother? I know he can speak well. And look, he's coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he'll be glad in your heart. So God is bluntly telling Moses, look, I'm going to get you help. You know, I know your brother. When we look ahead later, it'll mention God appearing to Aaron and telling him, go meet your brother. It's enough to make us wonder if when God is speaking to Moses, if he had already spoken to Aaron, or if he's just got the plan in place. And that's something we don't have to worry about. But basically, he arranges for the two brothers to work as partners. Aaron can speak well. He's coming out. He says, now you shall speak to him and put words in his mouth. I'll be with your mouth. I'll be with his mouth. I'll teach you what you should say. He'll be your spokesman to the people, and he himself shall be a mouth for you, and you'll be to him as God. Basically, Moses is going to be, you know, he's not going to be God. We know that. But as far as the Egyptians are concerned, Moses is this mysterious godlike figure, and Aaron is going to act as his prophet. Which still makes me wonder, we'll see later, you know, in these interactions with Pharaoh, this intercourse between, you know, Moses and Aaron and Pharaoh, and we don't know for sure who is doing the speaking, whether Moses or Aaron. And probably doesn't matter, but it, for me, visualizing it, it's something I'm curious about. I suspect that as time went along, Moses kind of got over this shyness or bashfulness and probably did a lot more of the speaking. And by the time we get them out of Egypt, it doesn't seem that there's any concern about that. Yes, Emily?
Do you think that this is like the first time he's hearing that he has a brother, Aaron? Or
no, I don't think so. Matter of fact, it's a good question to ask because I'll make the point later that they seem to recognize each other. You know, it says Aaron is going to be glad to see him. Notice he's Aaron the Levite here. Later he's going to be known as Aaron the priest, but he's not Aaron the priest at this point. Verse 18, Moses is going to follow custom of the time, and rather than just packing up and leaving, he's going to ask permission of his Jethro, his father-in-law, or as I've made the point, the Hebrew says he's a relative-in-law. Could be his brother-in-law by now, could still be his father-in-law, but he says, let me go back to Egypt, see if my brethren are still alive. Jethro says, go in peace. Now in verse 19 and 20, we see what seems to be a separate message from God. So God had spoken to Moses while he's out leading the flock. Moses goes back, meets with his family, starts packing up. God lets him know, and he said, go return to Egypt. And now he's going to let him know, you don't have to worry about being in hiding anymore. The men who sought your life are dead. So it's been a long time. The Pharaoh that wanted to kill you because you killed that Egyptian, you know, they're not on the lookout for you. Looking back at history, scholars of Egyptology, which I don't say that very often, but it's kind of neat that there's a field of study called that. They've looked at the various pharaohs who have lived long enough to have fulfilled this role, and pretty much there's two of them. And that fits the two different views of the chronology I've mentioned. There's Thutmose II, who would be the pharaoh if it's the further back in time, and Ramses II. Either one of them would have lived long enough to have had Moses raised in his household, and the pharaoh that Moses is going to go and confront. And we'll infer a few things about this pharaoh. For one, it will become obvious that this pharaoh is not the firstborn of his parents. And many times the firstborn is the one who succeeds to the throne. This one's not a firstborn. He's not going to die in the plague when all the firstborn are put to death, which gives us some thought when God is going to say, I raised you up, God hardens his heart. The idea that God arranged for this man to be ruling in Egypt at the time he was no accident. God sort of brought things about so the right person was there for God to be able to show all of his miracles. That's the point I was getting to. And there are a couple of men in history that seem to fit the description of how long they lived and where they were. But let's move on because we get something. If my describing this isn't confusing enough, the next story is pretty confusing, or seems to be. And the original Hebrew is pretty vague, and that's the reason the English is. Yeah, I thought I was there. I want to get through this first, though. In verse 22, it says, "Thus you'll say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me, and if you refuse to let him go, indeed I'll kill your son, your firstborn." This is mirrored in Hosea 11, verse 1. And I wanted to make reference to this because in Hosea 11, 1, it says, "When Israel was a child, I called him out of Egypt. I called my son." Later in Matthew 2 and verse 15, that's cited as a messianic prophecy. Because we know the story, Jesus, when he was just an infant, his stepfather Joseph and his mother Mary took him down to Egypt so that when Herod tried to kill all the babies, he would be spared. And then later, God sent message to Joseph, hey, it's safe to come back now. So God looked back at that, and he caused there to be this dual fulfillment. He here portrays the nation of Israel as his firstborn. But then again, later, Jesus Christ is the actual firstborn son of God. Sorry, when I talked about the confusing part, it's what begins in verse 24. "It came to pass on the way at the encampment," so it's a long journey, you have to stop and camp on the way, "the Lord met him and sought to kill him." Part of the confusing thing is there's hymns there without necessarily the proper antecedent to make sure we know exactly who the hymn is. "Then Zipporah," that's Moses' wife, "took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at Moses' feet and said, 'You're a bloody husband to me.' So he let him go, and she said, 'You're a husband of blood because of the circumcision.'" So we stop there and say, what's going on here? As I said, scholars say that the Hebrew is not entirely clear. The best understanding is that the hymn in verse 24, "the Lord met him and sought to kill him," most scholars looking at this believe it's one of Moses' sons. And we know from other passages that Moses has two sons. The elder is Gershom, which means stranger. The younger is Eleazar, which I'm not sure, don't remember what that means. And it seems then that one of them is not circumcised. So we wonder what happened, is God, God had required all males descended from Abraham to be circumcised. You remember that from way back in Genesis. Now we haven't seen any indication that God is going around killing anyone descended from Abraham who's not circumcised. That's one of the reasons this seems a little odd. Now, I've seen one speculation, and it's only speculation, but I've read this, that some think that Eleazar, they think that the son not circumcised was probably the second, and some have theorized that perhaps he developed an infection. And so they portray that as God seeking to kill him by letting him get sick with this, and then the circumcision alleviated it. I find that interesting, but we don't have a way to prove it one way or the other. The question is, why does it seem that one of them isn't circumcised and needs to be? And this is also speculation, but I find it believable. The idea, and I don't know how many of you have witnessed a circumcision, and I can say I haven't. Well, I've probably witnessed my own, but I don't have any memory of it, which is a good thing. But, it's kind of bloody, and the babies, when it's done to them, will cry because it's painful, and then fortunately they forget. But if this is something the Midianites didn't practice, it's possible that, Zipporah and Moses have their first son. 8th day comes, Moses said, "We've got to circumcise him." And she's going, "What are you doing to my baby?" And so when the second son comes along, she says, "No way, you're not doing this to my second son." And perhaps Moses gave in and didn't. So now there's a need, if Moses is going to go represent God, that, okay, your family's got to be in order. Again, this is all speculation, but it's one that seems like it could fit. And then, of course, Zipporah is angry. She does it to save the child's life, but she's still kind of angry at Moses. That seems to be true either way. That does also seem to fit if you turn ahead to chapter 18, we're coming right back in Exodus 18, verses 2 and 3. It's interesting, this is after the children of Israel have left Egypt. It says, "Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back with her two sons. One was Gershom, the other was Eleazar. And he says, I'm coming, you know. And so what that tells us is at some point, Zipporah and the two boys left Moses. My guess is that it happens after this. You know, they said, forget this, we're not going to Egypt, and they go back and stay until afterwards. That's also not provable. It's possible that Zipporah and the boys were there through most of the plagues and at some point went back to hang out with Jethro. But to me, the most logical thing is that here there's sort of a family argument, a disagreement. The boy, you know, probably isn't so good for doing a lot of traveling at this point, so she goes back and they'll be reunited later. In any event, there's still questions. And I'm okay with there being questions. When I get to meet Moses and talk to God in person, I'm eager to say, can you clear this up for me? You know, they say the Hebrew was vague and the English left some questions to be answered. Which tells me, do you have any questions to be answered that I might be able to answer? Is that a clear enough explanation?
It's just confusing about in 24, when you read that verse and it says that the Lord met him and sought to kill him. Who were you saying the Lord sought to kill?
So we believe that the Lord met and sought to kill Moses' son.
Okay.
And most scholars looking at this say probably the younger son, Eleazar.
Because he wasn't circumcised?
Right.
Okay.
So one of the sons obviously isn't, because Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son. So there's no indication that Moses needed to be circumcised.
Okay, thank
so it
you.
Seems to be one of the boys, because it doesn't say both boys. So we've come up with different ideas to try to explain what the story does tell us, but there's so many things it doesn't tell us that we have to admit that it's, you know, speculation. The one thing we do know is that, you know, reference to Acts chapter 15, that circumcision is not a requirement, you know, for religious reasons today. In other words, Christians, you don't have to be circumcised to be a Christian. And the Apostle Paul went out of his way to make sure we understood that. Many of us do still recommend it for health reasons, but that's a totally different matter. Okay, so having established what we can of this, we move, and here's the reference I didn't see earlier. In verse 27, the Lord said to Aaron, go in the wilderness to meet Moses. Interestingly, there it is. So he went on the mountain. He met him on the mountain of God and kissed him. So the mountain of God, that's where the burning bush first was. So remember, Moses, I think it's probably around here. Moses went back, met with his father-in-law, heading back towards Egypt. Aaron leaves and meets him. As I said, the two places are probably either around here or over here. But at any rate, they meet. They're glad to see each other. They seem to recognize each other, which makes us think, have they been in touch? Have they seen each other, you know, on and off over the last 80 years? And the answer, I don't know. But it doesn't seem that they're just now learning that they are brothers, to answer Emily's question. And I'm saying it seems because there's still room to speculate about that. This could be the first time they've seen each other in 40 years, and no wonder they're so happy to get together. I could say, you know, remember Moses had this long talk and makes up 5 different excuses not to go. Says God talked to Aaron and he left. So interesting how that comes about. So in verse 29, though, Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord who had sent him and all the signs which he commanded. So Moses and Aaron went. So they get back to Egypt. They gather all the elders of the children of Israel. And Aaron spoke the words of the Lord. So the people are saying, probably, what's up with this other dude who's just sitting there not saying anything? Or maybe not. Maybe Aaron says, oh, he has trouble talking. But Aaron does all this. Then he did the signs in the sight of the people. Again, the he probably is Moses, but perhaps Aaron. But the people believed when they heard that the Eternal had visited the children of Israel. We can note that visited, again, Genesis 50, verse 25, we could refer back to Joseph before he died telling his descendants, surely the Eternal will visit you. And he made them promise to take his body out. But it says, you know, they believed, they heard that he'd visited, they looked on their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshipped. Not only do I want to pause here because it's the end of the chapter, but also to give the Israelites credit. They don't believe God a lot of times. They don't worship him properly a lot of times. Let's give them credit this once. They hear this good news, they believe, and they worship. So they're doing something right, at least at this particular point. Okay, We move on then, so we're all on the same page, verse chapter 5. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go." So Moses and Aaron are going to represent all the Israelites. Although it doesn't say, you know, how long did it take to go in and see Pharaoh? That's, you know, he's the top dog. He's the chief guy. It's like if God came and told you, go speak to President Trump and give him a message, how easy would it be for you to walk into the White House and get to talk? My thinking is that Moses was raised in court. He knows the right ways to, I don't know, make a request. I would say file paperwork. I don't know how they do that. But Moses probably does the right things to get them in as quickly as possible. They make this request, you know, thus says the Lord God of Israel. This is the first time they're using, you see, it's L-O-R-D in all caps. So they're using the name that we say is probably Yahweh. Let my people go that they may hold a feast in the wilderness. Pharaoh says, who's this Yahweh that I should obey his voice or let Israel go? I don't know Yahweh. I'm not letting Israel go. This seems like it might well be the first time Pharaoh's ever heard of this God. And he's probably going to judge the power of this so-called God by the abject condition of the people who claim to worship him. Okay, you're the God of this group of slaves who have to do whatever we tell them. I'm not going to do what he says. You know, so Pharaoh just dismisses it out of hand. They move on, so they're not ready to be done. They said, look, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days' journey in the desert and sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall on us with pestilence. And the king of Egypt said, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from the work? Get back to your labor. So they say, this isn't just our request. This is a demand from God. And we know from what we've seen earlier, God was telling them what to say. Not yet revealing his ultimate plan to Pharaoh. Basically, he said, let us go 3 days. Pharaoh is going to say no. The ultimate plan is they're leaving permanently. So I think the idea, though, is Pharaoh says no to a pretty simple request. Now we're going to, you know, show him who he's dealing with, and eventually he's going to tell you, get out of here and don't come back. In verse 3, it says, you know, let us go sacrifice lest he fall on us with pestilence. Pestilence seems to be referring to plague, disease, whatever, and that's exactly what did happen to Egypt. Pharaoh didn't let them go. God unleashed the plagues. When he tells them, look, get out of here, get back to work, Pharaoh, you know, seems to be accusing Moses and Aaron of trying to arouse a slave revolt. You know, you're trying to get the people out of their work, and he tells them to go back to work. You know, which makes us wonder, does he know that Moses hasn't been working out there in the brick ovens for 40-some years? Matter of fact, he never has. Some scholars have said this might be in order to put them in slavery along with the rest of the Israelites. If so, though, it doesn't seem to come to pass. So anyways, Pharaoh gets this idea. In verse 5, Pharaoh said, is apparently speaking to his advisors and officials around, look, the people of the land are many, and you make them rest from their labor. So the same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, no longer give the people straw to make bricks. Let them go gather straw for themselves, but lay on them the same quota of bricks. You may not reduce it for their idol. That's why they cry out saying, let us go sacrifice. Let more work be laid on the men that they may labor and not regard false words. So here we see two terms, taskmasters and officers. From what we see in the course of the story, taskmasters seems to refer to the Egyptian overseers. So the Egyptians who are running things, whereas officers seems to refer to the Hebrews who are leaders among the slaves. They're still slaves themselves, but they kind of have that job of telling the other slaves what to do. Does that make sense? So he's making sure the word gets out. So, kind of sad, Pharaoh is going to punish all of the people because of the request that came from Moses and Aaron, although it was on request of all the people. And the idea of the straw, back then, the way they made the bricks, where they would mix up clay with, you know, hay, bits of straw to give it a certain texture and tensile strength. Yes, Kayla?
What did you say the officers were?
They were probably Hebrews who were leaders among the Hebrew slaves. Kind of like in the American South before the Civil War, you had slave drivers, you had white overseers, and then you'd have some among the slaves who were, you know, sort of down there, sometimes even having responsibility to whip other slaves and direct them in their duties. Okay, so anyways, since they needed the straw to make the bricks, you know, they'd mix that stuff together, usually dry them in the sun, or they might have ovens to actually do them the way we fire pottery today. This new policy is going to make an impossible task. You know, they were working as hard as they could before to mix this stuff up and make the brick. Now, in addition, they got to go out and get stubble. They don't have hay. They've got to pick whatever they can. In verse 10, of course, the taskmasters of the people and their officers went out, spoke to the people. Thus says Pharaoh, I'm not giving you straw. Go get yourself straw. People are scattered through all the land, so they're trying to do it. Verse 13, the taskmasters forced them to hurry, saying, fulfill your work, your daily quota. Also, the officers of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters set over them, were beaten. And this is probably a formal punishment. They're falling short, and scholars say that they probably would lay down and have their hands restrained and be beaten on the back with rods or whips. So I don't know how severely, but that enough to get their attention, I'm sure. And you have this thing, you know, basically they're going on saying, well, hey, what's going on here? You're telling us to make brick and you're not giving us straw. In verse 15, the officers of the children of Israel came to Pharaoh. So they're making an appeal. So this is the Hebrews, the overseers of the Hebrews are going to Pharaoh, probably thinking that his officers came up with this on their own. And so if Pharaoh just knew what was going on, he'll give us cut us a break. And then they find out that it's Pharaoh's idea in the first place. So they're making this appeal, and Pharaoh says, you know, verse 17, you're idle. That's why you say, let us go and sacrifice to the eternal. And you can imagine the light coming on for them. It's like they've had this change of policy. They're being punished. It's like, we got to go to Pharaoh and straighten this out. And then they find out this is coming from Pharaoh. And by what he says, you know, basically, I've made this policy because you're wanting to go sacrifice to this Yahweh. And as I said, suddenly they realize they've been caught in a trap. They listened to Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's laying it on them. Ah, so now they know where the source of this comes from. And in verse 19, and the officers of the children of Israel saw that they were in trouble, to say the least. Pharaoh's answer showed them that they could not expect mercy or justice in this case because it was an unjust policy, you know, but he's not going to change it. And in verse 20, it says, as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron. It's sort of like, I imagine they're in there and Moses and Aaron are waiting outside the door to see what's going to happen. Kind of like if, say, any of you went to meet Mr. Myers for some reason, and then you come out and someone else is waiting in the hall. So what did he say? You know, so they come out and basically they look at Moses and Aaron and say, well, what do they say? Let the Lord look on you and judge. So they're not happy with Aaron and Moses. You've made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and the sight of his servants. Put a sword in their hand to kill us. You know, they, as I said, they saw they were in trouble and they're blaming them. So Moses is going to go talk to God about this. I'll make the point later on in chapter 33, verse 11, God will say that he spoke to Moses face to face as a friend. It shows, and we'll see that relationship between them develops. Here is the first place we see Moses putting that into action. He's going to go talk very freely to God, perhaps not as respectfully as he should be. Because Moses goes, Lord, what have you brought trouble on these people? You know, why is it you sent me? What did you bother to give me this job for? Remember, he didn't want it. He tried to get out of it. He says, since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's done evil to the people. And neither of you delivered your people at all. So he's saying, look, you know, Pharaoh is treating us badly. You haven't fulfilled your end of the bargain. God, what is up with this? You know, I always advise we should be very careful about talking to God in that tone. But we see, again, God's great patience. He doesn't smack Moses around and tell him, how dare you talk to me this way? He gives him an explanation. He replies patiently. And he'll assure Moses that, yeah, Pharaoh, I will turn Pharaoh to my will. The Lord said to Moses, now you'll see what I'll do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand, he will let them go. And with a strong hand, he'll drive them out. So he's not only going to let them go, he's going to push you out. And he continues, he says, I am the eternal. as we say, or Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty, as El Shaddai, we would say in the Hebrew. And remember that the Yahweh is the, you know, the form based on the to be verb. He referred to himself earlier as I am who I am. Or if you want to say it's the to be, I be who I be. But that sounds too inner city for me. But he says, okay, that's who I am. But I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, but by my name, Yahweh, I was not known to them. That's caused some people some questions, partly because we've read the book of Genesis and we do see that name. You see the capital L-O-R-D, you know, in all caps. So there's a couple of explanations. The most common one is to think, okay, well, who put Genesis down in writing? It was Moses. And likely after this event happened, so Moses might have known who he was dealing with, and he used the name, he just inserted it where appropriate, even if maybe Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob didn't know that name. So that's a very common explanation, and I think the most widely believed. I noted the Expositor's Bible Commentary, which is a big multi-volume we've got in the library. It proposes a different theory. It says that the patriarchs might have used the name Yahweh. And when it says that by this name I wasn't known to them, it might be referring to their understanding rather than just knowing that the pronunciation of the name, that they might have said it but not fully realized who this was. You know, I can at least see that's a possibility. I think the former seems more likely, you know, because I don't know why Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob wouldn't have known, you know, what kind of God that they're dealing with here. But either way, I'm sure Moses seemed to understand it at the time. But God goes on in verse 4. He mentions Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I've established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimages in which they were strangers. And I've heard the groaning of the children of Israel. Basically, God is saying, I made a commitment. I'm going to fulfill it. In verse 6, he says, I'm the Lord. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from their bondage. And I will redeem you with an outstretched arm, with great judgments. That outstretched arm indicates using his power. And it's not just, I'm not just talking the talk, I'm going to bring this to pass. I'm going to make it happen. In verse 7, I'll take you as my people, and I will be your God, and then you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brings you out from under the burdens. So one of the ways God is going to make sure they knew is by letting them get in the worst condition they could be. They're already in slavery. Now he's going to get to let the slavery go to the extreme of where their masters are putting burdens on them that they just can't do, and they're getting beaten for it. So it's as bad as it can get, but God says, now I'm going to deliver you, when you can't deliver yourselves. And that's an important lesson for us when we think of their condition in Egypt as being symbolic of our condition in sin, that all of us get into a condition where we can't deliver ourselves, but God can and will. And it's worth noting when it says, then you shall know that I am the Lord, that's in the New King James. I think it's about the same in the Old King James as the New, but that appears 71 times in the King James Bible. 9 times are here in Exodus, and 57 of them are in Ezekiel. So we see the clusters there, and it's here and there in some other places. What I find it interesting, and the reason I put it in my notes to remind you, is that in Ezekiel, it's usually a place where it's a prophecy of the second Exodus, when God will bring the survivors of Israel back to the promised land. So we see it pertaining to the Exodus and to the second Exodus. And we can make the point that both in establishing the ancient nation of Israel and also in establishing the new nation of Israel and the kingdom of God, that God would use powerful miracles. And that's an important point. God would, you know, demonstrate his absolute power. We'll see the plagues on Egypt. He's going to part the Red Sea. And if you read Revelation, you see wondrous, powerful miracles, you know, to bring in the kingdom. Yeah, Julie?
The phrase you were just talking about, how many times did you say it appeared?
71. That's at least in the King James. I'm not sure if the New King James is the exact same. And this isn't something I would never test you on how many times something like this, but wanted to make that point. Okay, so coming back here in verse 9, Moses spoke thus to the children of Israel, but they didn't heed Moses because of the cruel anguish. And the Lord spoke to Moses. So we're not sure. This could be yet another time God comes to Moses. So he said, okay, you know, maybe they had this talk, you're upset. Now God tell Moses, go to Pharaoh. Go to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the children of Israel go out of his land. But Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, the children of Israel haven't heeded me. How shall Pharaoh heed me, who am of uncircumcised lips? The Israelites are discouraged. Moses seems to be discouraged himself. Seems like he's ready to give up. But God orders him to go back and carry on. Uncircumcised lips obviously is, you know, a slang or some kind of term, because you don't circumcise your lips. Some say that it is referring to some type of a speech impediment, but more scholars say he's just referring to his lack of effectiveness so far. I went to Pharaoh, he didn't let us go. My words aren't doing any good. But, and then verse 13, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and gave them a command. I think the old King James says, gave them a charge. So, or nowadays we might say he gave them a commission. And for the children of Israel and for Pharaoh and for Egypt to bring the people out. And now we go into a genealogy. So God's, you know, there's sort of a formal, I'm giving you guys this job. And to make sure we know who he's talking about, we see, you know, the mention of the of Reuben and Simeon. They were the firstborn and the secondborn of Jacob. Levi was the third. So he goes through Reuben and Simeon to make sure that we get to Levi. And this is to prove, you know, this is the Moses and Aaron who are descended from Abraham. And there's more emphasis on Aaron here because it will establish the priesthood. And I'm not going to read all these names. I'll note verse 20. It says, Amram took for himself Jochebed, his father's sister, as wife. I referenced this back early in Genesis when it says a man of Levi took a wife, a daughter of Levi. And Jochebed might well have been Levi's actual daughter. The Hebrew here would allow her to be a cousin rather than his aunt. But as long as people lived, it's not inconceivable he could have married, you know, he could have an aunt who's of a proper age to marry him. Not that you should be marrying your aunt, but that's, things were done a little differently back then. I say that, you know, my sister is only 2 years older than me, but all of her kids have children, all of her kids have kids who are older than my son. So there's like a generation difference because my wife got married at age 18 and started having kids. I didn't get married till I was in my 30s, and then we couldn't get pregnant right away. So it's not hard to imagine, you know, the difference in ages for these Levites. Oh, okay. I didn't marry my sister. Even though we're talking about marrying aunts and cousins and things. Okay. Sorry about that. So anyways, and I mentioned earlier when I introduced this that there's the possibility that this is just giving an overall, you know, basically telling the clan or the tribe, the clan and family leader, and maybe leaving out some generations. People who believe that they were in Egypt for 400 years believe that's the case. But it is possible also, if they were only in Egypt around 200 years, that this is very literal. And that, you know, Moses' mom, or if Jochebed was a daughter of Levi, the patriarch, then Levi is Aaron and Moses' grandfather. It's that close a connection. Anyways, this we're going to go all the way down. I'm going to skip to the end of chapter 6 because the idea is, well, we can see in verse 27, these are the ones who spoke to Pharaoh. So all this genealogy is to establish, yeah, it's that Moses and Aaron. And they are linked. We know who they are. We can put it together. And at the start of the book of Chronicles, you have this detailed genealogy of the houses of Israel. But it's still a little hard to follow because the Hebrew just has basically the word of. This name, of that, of that. And for the English, to make it more understandable, they include son of, or the father of, and based on the context. Anyways, let's move on to chapter 7. So the Lord said to Moses, I've made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother will be your prophet. You'll speak to all that I command you, and Aaron your brother will tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of his land. And I'll harden Pharaoh's heart. multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. Pharaoh won't heed you, so that I may lay my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. By great judgments, he's implying I'm going to do powerful things, and we'll see these miracles will do. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Eternal, when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring the children of Israel out from among them. And Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Lord commanded them. So Moses and Aaron are going to go to Pharaoh a second time. The first time they went as subjects making a petition. When they go back, they're not going to go as humble subjects of Pharaoh. They're going to go as representatives of God making a demand. So their approach is going to be a bit different. And one of the things, God is going to make the point that this is going to happen at your word. The plagues will start when they say they'll start. They'll stop when they say they'll stop. God will make it very clear that these aren't just happenstance, not natural occurrences. And we'll discuss that in a moment, because there have been a lot of scholars who've tried to explain how natural phenomena could have brought about what are described as the plagues. But it's not like that. And we see that phrase, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And that's caused some questions for people. I like to think of it as not that God forced Pharaoh against his will to not free Israel. But over in chapter 9, verse 16, is where it says, indeed, for this purpose I've raised you up, that I may show my power in you. So God is saying he raised Pharaoh up for this purpose. You know, and as I mentioned, we know Pharaoh wasn't the firstborn. So somehow God might have made sure that this man was on the throne at this particular time because he was that type of person. Now, there's places where it says God hardened his heart, but it's worth noting, matter of fact, I'll give you a couple verses. Chapter 8, verse 15, and also in 8, verse 32, and in 9, verse 34, it says Pharaoh hardened his heart. And I'm not asking you to memorize these, I'm just making the mention that sometimes it'll say God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Other places it says Pharaoh hardened his heart. Either way, this Pharaoh is a hard man. You know, think of Old West. Any of you guys ever see City Slickers? The movie with Billy Crystal? Boy, it's going. You guys, it's worth seeing. It's a good one. It has Jack Palance playing the old cowboy. You know, and he's this old hardened leathery cowboy. And I think one of the times they say he's like a saddlebag with eyes, you know. But the idea is he's really tough. And it's like this Pharaoh was a calloused person. I don't mean calloused on his hands. He probably didn't have to do much hard work. But he's somebody, he'd seen things. He'd been through emotional things. Perhaps he was just hardened in his mind. And maybe God had allowed those events to happen. So when it says God hardened Pharaoh's heart, doesn't necessarily mean like he did it right then, when they're saying, oh, we're suffering these plagues and God won't let Pharaoh let him go. But God had arranged things or allowed things to happen in this Pharaoh's life so that he was a calloused, hardened person. He had a hard heart. And so he kept coming back to saying, no, I'm not going to let you go. Anyways, I wanted to, yes, Emily?
Sorry, but how do we know that he was the second born?
Well, we don't know that he was the second, but if he had been the firstborn, he would have died in the plague when God killed all the firstborn in the land. But Pharaoh, he lost his firstborn, but he himself didn't die. So that's just one indication that, okay, maybe he had an older brother who would have been Pharaoh, but that brother died for whatever reason and he came to the throne. So a lot of this is speculation. I just wanted to address it here, and then as we move along, when it says Pharaoh hardened his heart or God hardened his heart, we won't stop and dwell on it too much. And let me cover just one couple more things here. In chapter 7, verse 7, we get the ages that I've referenced before. Moses was 80 years old and Aaron was 83 years old when they spoke to Pharaoh. So here's how we know Aaron was the older brother, even though Moses has a greater preeminence. We also know that they had a sister, who we'll find out her name was Miriam, and she was older than both of them. You know, she's the sister that was on the riverbank watching to see what's going to happen to her little baby brother. So we guess that she was 8 or 10 years older than either of them. And we could put this together saying God had spent a lot of years carefully preparing Moses and probably Aaron as well. Remember, we look at Moses' life. 40 years he was raised in Pharaoh's court and educated and became mighty in words and deeds. Then he spent 40 years out in the wilderness being a shepherd, being humbled, but also, I'm sure, learning a lot of lessons. So by this point, he's ready for the job that God has for him. Even though Moses himself doesn't think he's ready. He's coming up with every excuse he can think of. But it's just a lesson I think is worth us keeping in mind, that God might have been and might be preparing us for jobs or tasks that we have no idea of. But when the time comes, it's worth thinking, okay, God has gotten us ready for this. A scripture I like to cite, is one of my favorites in the Bible, is in the book of Esther. Esther chapter 4 and verse 14, when Mordecai sends this message to Esther, because, and we'll cover this later, she knows she needs to go speak to the king to try to save her people, but she's afraid she could get killed. Mordecai says, "Who knows but what you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Who knows but what you've come for such a time as this? God could have said to Moses, "I've been getting you ready for just this time." And that could apply to any of us many other times. Having said that, and talking about time, it's time for us to take a break. So let's take 10 and then come back, and we'll start moving more speedily through the plague.